The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren Lojudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. Well, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I am here right now. It is October. The days are getting shorter, and I am doing my routine, which I talk about here, which is lots of vitamin D. I have that sad light cranked up. Yep. Oh, man. I get seasonal affective all like pretty hard. So I pretty hard deal with it in advance. I get yelled at by my doctor for sucking down too much vitamin D. And I'm like, man, I can't get me enough because the opposite is not fun. Having no vitamin D, man, it gets me depressed. People tell me this is not in the realm of what the research suggests, but I'm like, it's in the realm of what I experience. So I'm sucking down that D. That does not sound right. Okay. You come see my stand-up, you know that's in line to some of the ironic stuff that I talk about. Okay, being a queer person, ending up with a dude. So it's in line there. All right. So, well, all, speaking of shows, I have a big show coming up for our holiday show for the Misfit Variety Show. I'm so excited. It's directed by Kate Sisk, and we are collaborating on, wow, what a fun show. I feel like the show is just like a love letter to Misfitry. It will make you feel happy. We need things that are going to lift us up, and this is one of them. It is designed to lift up. You cannot come and not feel inspired when you leave. Speaking of inspired, I think you're going to be inspired by this episode today. This interview with Chris Wilcha is one of my favorite conversations I've had recording this season. Now, before we go to this interview, just a reminder, please rate and review the podcast because social proof is super important for Misfits because Misfits trust other Misfits to know what's good. You could sign up at laurenloji.com for monthly updates or, you know, hey, you want to support us? You could also sponsor a podcast. Yes, we make it accessible to individuals or small businesses to support us. So listen, just go to Lauren Loji, click on Listen Podcast, and you can contact us there. All right. So today we are interviewing director Chris Wilcha. He's the director of the documentary Flipside, which we talk about in depth. You're going to hear all about what it is. But also he is a very successful commercial director. He has done tons of advertising campaigns that have won awards, like for big brands like Canon and Chevy and Kind and Facebook and Airbnb. And we get super existential about it, about what art means. Like, what does this all mean? And how do we do it? How do we make things that are meaningful for us in a world that is insane, in an entertainment ecosystem that is collapsing before us because of some world events and also because of technological shifts and how that's changing everything. I mean, we talk about all of it. We have to figure this out together. And so that's what we're doing here. We're starting the conversation. I'm so excited to bring this to you. Let's get to the interview with Chris Wilcha. Cool. All right. Well, thank you, Chris Wilcha, for joining us at Misfits Making It.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you probably don't know this. So I'm a millennial and I am obsessed with Gen X. I think you are all the greatest generation.
Wow.
You are. The other greatest generation, that was wrong. That was a mistake because you are the last people in humanity to go through your full adult development without leaving evidence behind.
Now, what do you mean by that in terms of like, because I think about now you mean purely a digital footprint in the ether available to the public?
Yeah. Like you were such degenerates. You guys did. So I've heard so many stories from Gen X friends of all of the crazy things you all did. And like, there's nothing in the cloud. Maybe someone has a photo somewhere in a basement in a box.
At your parents' house or something.
It's like, Yeah. And you had like the full adult development without like cognizant of the fact that like this might never disappear. Like you made a mistake. It was like, all right, this is just swept under the rug and we're never going to talk about this again.
Yeah. You know, I haven't interrogated that much, but it's absolutely true. There was a kind of quiet secret you know, experience of living that was not performative in any way. You know what I mean? And was very internal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I am a weird exception in that I was kind of maybe a little bit fixated on that in a very pre-blog, pre-social media way, where I would bring cameras everywhere, right? So when I got out of high school, I was lugging around this high camera and documenting, you know, all of my personal life and professional life as I was trying to sort of make my way in the world. And then I always had these point and shoot cameras. So I was a bit of a documenter and a saver of stuff. But no, I totally hear what you're saying, that my life did not play out publicly. And like every photo is not available, you know, in a timeline. You know? Yeah. The only thing that freaks me out slightly is I still have a little bit of that analog anxiety about when the stuff you've posted or have goes away or disappears or some, you know what I mean? Something like, in other words, I still like the artifact, like especially photos. I don't know why I'm still a little attached to like the printed photo, but I don't, now I'm sounding like old and Gen X.
Well, what do you do? Well, do you like, do you print them out? Like, how do you handle this anxiety?
You know, occasionally I am not a fetishizing film. I do, you know, still shoot a little bit of film, but it's mostly like a kind of two rolls a year novelty. There's definitely, I'm not holding on to a lot of that era. I'm not like a kind of analog fetishist.
Right.
So anyway, But are you, was your like high school life fully documented? Or was that like pre, was that like MySpace-y? Like,
it was like slowly like becoming online. Yeah. And then like by college, you know, it was kind of like, I'm an elder millennial. So it was like half in, half out. Like the kind of, my friend described it like the internet, like we grew up with the internet grew up with us.
Yeah.
So it was like getting more and more documented.
When you reflect on that era though, was there one phase of it that you look back on and you really feel like you were a social media guinea pig? Because I feel like there's a lot of theorizing now of like, there was this era where it was just, you know, there was it was the Wild West, bullying, self-harm, like shit was going crazy. Do you have a memory of like the really, truly kind of like crazy period?
Well, I was a little bit, I was a hater on social media for a long time because like, meaning not a hater, like active, like a hater of it, because my parents divorced over an affair that occurred through meaning on the internet. So I was like, fuck internet. I hate this stupid thing. I was very like anti that. So I didn't experience that, but like, I just remember like, well, I will say this. I remember going to Italy and performing and they were like, maybe like, I want to say like 5 or 6 years behind us. And then like, it was so different. I realized the moment when I looked around and no one was on their phone and I was like, oh, this, that means we're all always on our phone. You know, like it's a different way of being
Totally.
That moment. So, I probably, I'm probably just, you know, just like so traumatized by the whole thing too, that like, I don't even notice like how much I was a guinea pig for the whole situation. Even like not liking it probably somehow factored into their algorithm or study or something.
When did you break and actually embrace?
That's when I realized for comedy, like I had to do it for business reasons, for better or worse. Yeah.
So being a comedy branding was the moment that you were like, I have to give into this. I have to post, I have to participate. I can't just exist outside of it.
Yeah. But I do like try to like, you know, I do try to like, I feel like there's all these people who are like on social media and sad and they don't know where to go. And they like feel so alienated and alone and different. And I feel like I'm there to like help them, like shine a little light being like, come, like you can feel okay. So I justify it.
It's a positive space for you, which is
I try. Well, you know, the usual. But okay, so Flip Side is amazing.
Sorry.
No, it's all good. No, it's all good. No, this is Tangent City, everyone. It's a little bit crazy here. Okay, all right. So that's my handy soundboard. All right. So Flip Side is incredible. I'm sure you know that. So for those who don't know what it is, and I know it's like a hard. I've heard you talk about how it's a hard movie to like just be like, hey, it's this thing. But I guess if you could, you know, try to, you know, give people an idea.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna try for concision. But basically, the most basic foundational part of it was that, you know, in my 40s, I went back to this record store that I worked at in high school, and I make documentaries and I'm also a commercial director. And when I went back there, I had this incredible wave of nostalgia for the place. And I was like, this place is so beautiful and it's going to disappear at some point. I should make a little short film about this record store I worked at in high school. And then as I was doing that and shooting there, I was like, wait a minute, I love this place. I feel like there's maybe a story, a bigger story to tell about it. But, you know, as tends to happen in one's creative life, you pick up projects and you put them down at any given moment. You know, you can focus on them and not, especially when there's no money. So this was a complete labor of love kind of project. And so a lot of time was passing. And lo and behold, let's say 10 years passed. And I found myself mid-pandemic kind of going through some old hard drives. And I was like, I still feel like there's a film here. But I was also looking through and seeing a lot of projects that I had abandoned. So, you know, as a documentary person, you often take a run at things like an idea or a subject or a person, a character or a story that you just start shooting. And for whatever reason, it falls apart. You know, you're making a lot of failed attempts. And so in my case, you know, sometimes it's because money would run out. Sometimes it's because the person you were shooting wasn't interested in being the subject of it anymore. But I started looking through all these old hard drives and I had all these unfinished projects. And I sort of, you know, wondered, and they shared themes, you know, some of them had echoes between them of ideas and obsessions of mine. So I went about with a small group of people that I collaborate with a lot, trying to put together a film, sort of a kind of first person essay film about how one leads a creative life, about finishing things, about not finishing things, about family life. And again, returning to this kind of former fountain of youth, you know, this record store where that held a lot of meaning for me, and trying to figure out, you know, look back on that experience. I mean, that is the most horrendous pitch of all time in terms of like, that's not exactly a quick, short thing. I think what I end up saying a lot is like, in midlife, midlife crisis, I'll go back to this record store that I worked at in high school and try to save it before it disappears. That's kind of like the bad version.
Right.
I think it's, you know, there's so much stuffed in there. And that's actually why it was hard to pitch as an idea. Like I would talk to people about it and they would be like, there's too many things, you know, like I had a treatment that was just like pages and pages of description and photos. And I think many people recommended to me, just go make it. Like you have to just make the thing. You know what I mean?
Because so, in so anyway. Many ways, this was never been done before, from what I understand, something like this, a project like this. So
really?
I think so, right? I saw a quote about it, like a jump forward in the genre or something to this effect.
Oh,
right?
I mean, I personally, I'm always self-conscious about other precedents and references.
Right.
And, you know, like for instance, Errol Morris did do a film out of a handful of films that I think he didn't finish, but it was not first person. It was more just like seeing if he could take these forgotten pieces. You know, there's probably some precedents before, but no, but I a review like that was one of the ones where you're like, wow, thank you. Because we were trying to try something new and, you know, it's hard to sort of innovate. I think documentaries are still sort of this endless creative possibilities reside within that form.
Yeah.
So messing around with it. And I always think the first person is always such an interesting mode of storytelling, because you can digress and you can bring in a lot of random observations and ideas and sort of thread and braid them together in a way that you kind of can't in a more traditional documentary. So anyway, that was kind of the hope.
Well, I mean, this is something that it's not like, hey, we're going to make a movie on the origin of pillows and this factory in Arkansas that makes pillows. Like that's easy, you know?
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I think a lot of people come into Flipside thinking, oh, this is going to be about old record stores.
Right.
And I think that it's kind of great that if a person actually sits and watches, because you know, it's very distracting moment of, you know, can someone even sit through a movie anymore? But what's actually, I've had this great experience recently is Flipside is currently showing on Delta. And I think a person sitting on an airplane is a really great captive audience. And I feel like the airplane watchers, when they message me, are really attentive viewers because they're just trapped. And so they really respond in a positive way. So,
I mean, I feel you, because it's hard to like when you're different, it's hard to explain it because you like are it and you're building it and inventing it as you go along. And then it's like, how do I present this to someone from like their point of view, but also like really explain the project? It's really hard. It's really hard. You had many different strands of different documentaries, so many hard drives. I was like, this is so much footage. Like, I just kept my brain was like, how did you organize? Like, what magical organization system did you have?
I mean, you know, it was one of those moments in time. And I think, again, this was what was unique about COVID is you kind of had the time to kind of actually go back to the thing. And so I think I just had to do this clumsy process of just looking. A lot of that footage was in analog format. So for instance, Hi8 videotapes. And by digitizing it all, Super 8 film, you can actually scrub pretty quickly in a way that you couldn't, you know, imagine, you know, whatever, 15 years ago, you'd be putting your little cassette in and you'd be like,
oh my God.
You'd have to like watch everything. So there was a way in which there was an ability to sort of metabolize it a little more quickly when it was digital. Yeah. So that was sort of helpful. But I think we just started making buckets of stuff and the projects themselves were a convenient organizing device. You know, for instance, one of the films in Flipside, a film within the film, is about Ira Glass, who I'd worked with previously on a TV version of This American Life. He reached out about starting something that ultimately never got made, but we started it. And, you know, there was a fixed amount of footage where I was documenting this show he was doing. He was doing a live show where he was dancing and doing radio with a woman named Monica Bill Barnes. And I went back to that and I was like, God, it's such a shame that this is languishing, that this is just never going to see the light of day. So, you know, that was where what we would do is we'd sort of try to make sense of a chunk of the unfinished idea. And then a breakthrough with the guy I was editing with, a guy named Joe Beshinkovsky, was that we started to break them into pieces and see that if you could introduce one early, could it recur? Right. Could a character come back from one of the unfinished films? And then could they start to talk to each other? So could a film that I made about a jazz photographer, could that have echoes with something I attempted to do about a writer, you know, Starley Kine, who it makes a brief appearance. So anyway, that was a real editorial high wire act. That was kind of the fun and terror of making the thing.
There was, I have the program. This was a thing at the Met. The Met had opened this like other satellite before COVID, the satellite, and they had a whole exhibit about unfinished, like what it is to finish something or not finish it. It was good. I have a catalog to show. Look, I'm so cultured.
Wait, what's an example of something that was
in there? Well, there were the different reasons for not finishing. Like someone, she painted someone the day before he left. He was drafted and it was the day before he left. And she only did certain parts of his body as like a statement about leaving. Then there was like the Revolutionary War when the Americans won. They showed up for the portrait of both sides signing the papers. The British did not. They ghosted. They were mad, I guess, about how it turned out.
Yeah.
So things like that. And I guess one of the things they talk about is like finishing something by like, you know, there's a certain, I think when you end the creative project, there's a certain, someone's got to push that boulder up the hill and like make this thing happen. Like it's hard and it sucks and it's like just arduous often.
The worst.
But then what do you like sometimes for, how do you know if you're forcing it? You know, like this thing is not meant, like, cause there's always a moment when you're like, is it my kidding? Like, is this not supposed to happen? But is it not supposed to happen? Or is it always supposed to happen? Like, what is your feeling on that?
I mean, I think it took me a long time to really maybe understand the true kind of day-to-day labor of the creative process, that like you constantly have to return to it and iterate on it. These are cliches, but like writing is rewriting. Right. Like I, for a long time, would think about things and I'd have all these ideas, but I wasn't doing the thing. I wasn't writing the thing. I wasn't editing the thing. I was assembling, I was gathering footage. I had the ideas. But, you know, the only place these things get made is in the actual doing.
Yeah.
And I feel like that just was a really hard lesson. Like I recently wrote something and I finally feel like maybe, I don't know, it's age or experience or something, but I finally was like, okay, the first day it was terrible. The second day it was also terrible, but I liked one sentence. The third day I thought of a cool intro. You know what I mean? And it's just like that crazy, ridiculous, endless process, that breadcrumb trail, that weirdly addictive problem solving. I finally can sit in the suffering of it and the discomfort of it in a way that I just realized so much of it is busy work. So much of it is like just going back to it and just running at it and trying to fix the thing you hate. And that just took me a long time to realize, as far as if the thing should get made. That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think there's always this moment when you're making something where something clicks and it becomes kind of assured of its own completion, even if it's not done and it has a long way to go, but you can sort of be like, oh, wow, okay, this has some infrastructure to it now. And I can kind of, I can see that if I just put one foot in front of the other for like another couple of days or weeks or months, that the thing is going to be a good thing. Do you know what I mean? Like there's enough clues.
Yep.
So I feel like I haven't abandoned anything in a while. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I kind of got comfortable with the torture. And then I think another thing that was, maybe this is like a Gen X thing too, maybe not, but okay, let's talk generationally for a second. I think I got very stuck in a certain masterpiece thinking, which is like, you have to hold on to the thing and you cannot release it into the world until it is perfect and thought through and mixed and everything is exactly as you want it to be. And I think digital life, you know, kind of millennial digital life was like, you know, move fast and break things was that corny flip Facebook. But the idea was, is you publish, you push into the world. It's not unfinished. It's not polished. You put your life out there. And it took me so long also to get over that thing. And I think it's a way smarter way to work, right? Is you just put it out, you get feedback, you keep making it better and better and better. So anyway, I don't know if I answered your question, but that was some thinking about the torture.
I mean, it's hard to know. It is hard to know. And I think sometimes too, like with all of this, like you, some of the things that the projects that you had, like it was just bad luck. Like guy died, girl didn't write book, you know, like, and so some people will say like, well, like, you know, it brought you to where you are and there's no mistakes and all this stuff. I mean, do you agree with that or not? Or is it like just pretty to think so?
Well, the true trick of it all was just that I did something with that stuff. I think it would have been very easy to be defeated and to be like, there's no there. I didn't make the thing. The Starley thing fell apart. The Herman Leonard thing fell apart. I think it could have so easily, that stuff could all have just languished. And by the way, the technology, the hard drives were also starting to fail. The footage was starting to decay in ways. There was, there's this chapter in the documentary about a jazz photographer named Herman Leonard. And at some point we could not find the master tapes. And what we had was a shittier, lower resolution of what should have been, you know, better shot footage. I feel like I'm not answering your question. I think that it took an incredible act of will. And I'm not exactly sure. I think what propelled me was that I had collaborators, if I'm being totally honest with you. Because when this project was personal and I was in it. And that's not the norm for what I do kind of on a day-to-day basis. And I think that I needed this group of people to be like, there's something here, keep pushing. Because I would see stuff with myself in it and I would have no perspective. I would be like, I hate this. I don't like what I'm saying. I don't like the thought I'm having. And it was way more painful than if I was just editing, you know, a biographical documentary about a musician or an artist or something. You know what I mean? Like that. So there was like an extra layer of like pain because it was personal. But I mean, do you feel that way when you're developing stuff?
Do you feel
the pain?
Oh yeah, 100%. And when you were saying like, I hate it, I was just thinking of a joke. Like, I'm like, I hate that joke. I hate it so much. I'm so mad at it.
And you go out though, and you have to also do that publicly to test it, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like it lives or dies based on the audience interaction, and then like where I try it, and then I'm like, is it the audience? Is it me? And it's like you have to go out again and like in with great energy and good faith, try it again. Like it's the best joke you've ever had, and that's hard. I mean, I think the hardest thing for me has been like just to have the confidence to go and try with full confidence every time. Because that affects how people see it. Yeah.
Do you do that thing? I just feel like it's such a comedy rite of passage, but are you just like out there doing it publicly as much as you can? Like you're any stage you'll get on and you just are constantly performing?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I will get on stage as much as I can. I will say though that I avoid rooms of all comics, like open mics with like all comics, usually bros who are like staring at you wanting you to fail. Like that's not productive. maybe we could skip that.
Yeah.
But otherwise it's great. I love it. Like, you know, rooms you think you're going to die in. Like let's go. Let's bring it. But that's a clown. Clown has helped me with that. A lot.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
Yeah. I'm intimidated.
Clown school. Well, you were in LA. You're like, it's a huge clown scene. Do you know that?
I don't think I really do. No. Tell me about it.
Yeah. There's like 5 clown schools just in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And clown is all about failure. And like, you embrace the flop, like you're go out there and you, with your full heart, you give it, and then you flop, and then you like admit it to the audience, like acknowledge with them. Maybe that's your next documentary.
No, it sounds very, it sounds terrifying, but I'm sure liberating once you break through and do funny stuff and you're actually on a roll.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then the way there is often like really, until you get there, it's pain. It's pain, like you're saying. Like,
yeah. Is it so competitive out there? Like, are these open mic nights like super saturated with people and just too many, like everyone wants to go up? And I mean, because LA, speaking of another failed project, in the movie I talk about, I made this making of Judd Apatow's film, Funny People. And so as a consequence, one thing I was doing is I was going out and seeing a ton of comedy and documenting a lot of it, because we were thinking about making a kind of companion documentary. And, you know, it was wild to sort of watch and absorb the life of working comics, you know, of just trying to get out there, and people who obviously had, this wasn't even their, you know, it's not their day job, obviously.
Right.
But it, the work of it and the sort of, you know, the rewards are, can be very minimal in that development phase, right? When you're not just like rolling out and selling out shows. And
yeah, for sure. Yeah. You're like, if I can't bring, until you're bringing your own audience, it like, it's tough. For sure. Sure. And I feel like you're saying about like being different. Like, I am different, and like, I'm zany. I don't look like anyone else. I'm not sitting there. I don't talk about the usual things that people talk about. And I'm fun. I'm good. I have like faith in what I'm doing, but it's like a comedy club. Like, it's much safer to hire someone who looks like everyone else and just talks about their pussy or their penis. And they're like, that's what, you know, it's what it is, but it's a lot easier.
Yeah. And do you feel pretty confident in the voice you've developed? Like, you feel like you've got your frequency that you're operating on now? You're feeling good about the kind of work you're making?
I mean, right now, but tomorrow is another day. But I don't want to change. Like, I can't change. You know, like, why? Why? I respect too many Gen X people I feel like are true to their voice, and I can't let them down.
Oh my God. Wow. Do you have comedy idols who are Gen Xers?
That's interesting, because a lot of people I admire who are Gen Xers are like not like Andrea. Like, I admire Andrea Clare, a mutual friend. I admire her so much. Gen X, you know, just like people. But I guess like Maria Bamford's Gen. I've been seeing Maria Bamford's Gen X.
Oh my God, she's iconic. Iconic,
yeah. So it's like,
there's a documentary about her someone's working on.
I heard about that too.
Yeah.
Can't wait because to see it. I thought she said no, because she was talking. She has a bit in her act about saying no to it, but maybe she said yes finally.
I think they've worn her down, because I know someone who's kind of involved, and I feel like she's participating. I think it might be done soon too. Who knows?
Amazing.
But I can't. She's amazing.
She wouldn't say who it was. She only used McDonald's characters to talk about it. She would say, "Let's call him Grimace."
So good.
Yeah. So do you think, like, what do you think about like luck, like the role? I mean, it's talked about a little bit, but like sometimes, okay, I have a lot of friends who like torture themselves with thinking like, oh no, talent rises to the top and therefore it's all based on merit. And I'm like, I think luck, some people say luck has a lot to do. What do you think?
God, yeah. I think there's a phenomenal amount of luck involved. I mean, because I feel like I've seen people who work so hard, and sometimes it just doesn't happen, and they're great and amazing and they're talented. I mean, there's just this weird alchemy to when things click, right? With an audience or with some patron or some person takes a shine to you and champions you. And yeah, I mean, that was another, again, lesson I feel like I learned was, I think I thought that like you make a thing and people start knocking on the door, and I feel like that doesn't happen. You know what I mean? Like, and don't get me wrong. There are these stories from like, oh, his film was at Sundance and now he's making a Marvel movie or whatever. I feel like those are totally the exception. And especially now, I mean, I don't know how much you've been out there pitching or doing things, but like, I just feel like the marketplace is so weird and the streamers aren't buying anything. And the only thing anyone wants is like true crime or celebrity driven stuff. And it's just a very weird moment because, you know, you used to be able to kind of be like, okay, I'm going to follow my voice. And, the, you know, now it's like, how do you make a living in the midst of it all? But anyway, I'm going down a dark rabbit hole.
Right. And that's what it's something you had talked about. The New York Times did that Gen X article. Yeah.
Yeah. That was grim.
Yeah. It was intense. And you talked about, like, you know, the way forward, you know, like you had gone out and you were like touring with this thing, you were getting people in seats, and you said, like, it made no money, but what it did do, and this is what I believe Gen X is, creative person, it confirmed my belief that continuing to make stuff is the path forward.
Oh God.
So like,
Do I still believe it? No, I'm kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still, how is that? Cause we're saying like, it's harder to make money that way. And like, how do you do it? Like how is like these two things possible? You know, this is the way forward. Like we just got to like make our stuff, see it through. And then like, it's also acknowledgement. Like these things are also really hard to have make money.
Yeah.
Like how do you do it?
I mean, I think what I meant by that was, I just keep trying to have ideas and follow them and pursue them and pitch them and make them. And like, that's the only muscle I know how to flex. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like, so what that means is, you know, like I'm working on some documentary stuff. I'm still hustling commercial directing work to make a living. But then I'm also like having conversations with friends about like, okay, the AI-ness of it all, like how do you locate some value in there or some way to use those tools that are now about to overwhelm us or run us over? You know what I mean? Like, how do you not, you know, like, I don't think I can just protest them and pretend they don't exist. They're already embedded, you know, in it. It's not some abstraction far off in the horizon. It's literally impacting my life every day now. Like, just as an example, like in the commercial directing work I do, like, you know, there was a time, maybe, you know, the last 20 years, let's say, where, you know, if you had a short form story you were trying to tell, and there was like a shot of a guy jumping out of a parachute, you would go out and you would shoot that. You'd get the stunt guy in the plane and you'd organize it and plan it and storyboard it, and the agency would pay for it. And that might cost, you know, I don't know, a couple $100,000 or something for that one shot. That is now a prompt, right? They're not spending that money to go do the, they might want to shoot other things. They might want actors to interact in a space or read a script.
Yeah.
But those big ticket things that used to generate income and jobs, and think of all the people who were there that day, the hair and makeup and the wardrobe and the transportation guys and the DP, that's all gone. That shoot day doesn't exist anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so like, I'm, you know, I was just sitting with a friend last week and we were like, where do we exist in this? How do you use this tool in a compelling way? You know what I mean? So I don't know. To me, it's an addictive, creative problem solving that I just keep engaging with, but it's intimidating. And it's this doesn't just feel like some lull where it's like, oh, the pendulum will swing back and it's all gonna, this feels very like the ground beneath our feet is shifting in an incredibly dramatic way. And I haven't totally processed it, to be totally honest with you. I mean, are you thinking about this stuff? I mean, you're in a performance-based medium where you're getting out and getting in front of people. But yeah.
Right. I mean,
in production, it's a little terrifying.
Right. For sure. I mean, it definitely like changes like the path to make money, because we're comedians make a lot of money through like acting, getting on shows, and there's like less of them, you know, like there's less of that to go around now. People were being paid less even before the strike. Yeah. I mean, it was just like, so it's like that's the way to make money from this. I don't know. And then it's like, you know, even thinking about like, you know, a lot of people have to like take the production cost onto themselves. Like, all right, so if you want to create stand-up hour, great. Like go spend a lot of money on creating your own special. And like, then it's like, how much should I, you know, how much should I spend based on who I think I could sell it to? Wow. But if I don't sell it to them,
That's intimidating.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then it's like the, you know, AI can be a friend and like helping, you know, just with some small, like, cause you have to be like a content machine. So it does help in that way. That's a positive. And you're also competing against everyone else who has those same tools. So it's an interesting thing. Are we just posting ourselves to death? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either.
Yeah.
I'm not sure either, honestly.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, we're still like, we're trying to like AI is changing it. And it's like, is the person who's going to figure out how to use it the best, I guess, first up the mountain, and they're going to benefit the most and like so many things. And then the rest of us will get the phrase.
Be collecting our universal basic income. And
yeah. Yeah.
Figure out what to do with ourselves watching our AI generated content.
Yeah. I mean,
anyway, I didn't mean to go dark on you.
Well, no, I mean, it's true.
It's just something I'm thinking about a lot because it's coming up constantly. Well, like,
one thing is we have experience in like ground. I feel like a creative profession, you have experience of like ground shifting beneath your feet, because that's, even though now it's like more dramatic, it's more or less, there's things, you know, you're kind of a freelancer a lot. It's, you know, things are changing always.
Yeah.
Now that all these STEM people are being AI'd out. So what advice do you have to the nerds about how to deal with this? Because they've never had it. They went to STEM like, I'm going to be safe. I'm not going to be no painter. I'm going to learn how to code and have a job for life.
That's interesting. So you're sort of thinking, I mean, have you reflected? Because the misfit path used to be, I don't know, there was kind of a clear way to go about it. It's like you were offering something that was the alternative, right? You know, mainstream culture, you could react against that. But I feel like all of those bright lines have blurred and the audiences have, shrunk into these micro niches. And I don't know. I mean, and there are people who are doing unusual and unique things, but maybe not with the sort of coded coolness that we used to understand as alternative or misfit stuff. I don't know. Have you thought about that? Like, is that something that you come up against, of just even finding an audience for your stuff?
You think, because, are you saying just because like, because there's so much like people, everything's a niche. So then like, what is like more like thinking like a David Bowie kind of misfit thing where it's like broad appeal yet niche at the same time? Is that what you mean?
Well, that would be like that would be the top of the mountain for like a certain kind of yes, like you, that you could be doing something artistically ambitious and, you know, literary and thoughtful, and then also accomplish mainstream success. Like that was a model that was available at one time.
Right.
And I think that is still a path to go, but I feel like the kind of, the way you could define yourself against mainstream culture, there was something very clear and, you know, you were reacting against these things.
Yes. Yes. And now it's not quite like that. Yes, I do. Cause like what I think and talk about is like being weird, being different, being a misfit. And I think now it's a little bit more what I'm finding. It is a little more difficult to get an audience. Cause it's like when you're talking about like between categories, that's where a lot of my people lie. They're just like, I am like queer, but I don't totally fit in always. Like I'm working class. I don't fit in my family. Like that's kind of like, you know, people are in a matrix of just not belonging to any group, and the algorithm likes groups and they like tags and easy. So that is 100%. It's hard. What I have done is like think of subcategories of things and like talk about specific ways that I don't quite fit the mold and like really try to hit those hard.
And do you feel like you've managed to gather a tribe?
Yeah. I mean, I need to get it bigger, if I'm being honest, to really be able to tour. Like, So, I mean, I growing. Like, I do feel like we crowdfunded for a short film in the fall, and I was like, oh my God, all this work I've been doing this last few years, like, is coming to fruition. Like, we succeeded, and it was great. And amazing. I was just so, people, like, I had no idea who they were, and they were like, donate. I was like, well, this is great. Like, it works. It super works. And knowing like what I really want to do and like being out on the road for a bit and doing all that, like I need to get more of a critical audience. All right. So how do you do that? Is online, but online makes it difficult to find those people, if this makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No. Is there virtue in just like going out and being a road warrior and just like playing and traveling and going and going and doing the same loop again and go, you know what I mean? That kind of like old school kind of indie band mentality.
You know, there's like less and less money to go around. So that's harder. There is virtue in doing that. And I have done it, trying to think about like, how do I make this? Because it's a ton of work for like, not, you know, a lot of return in terms of money, although like audience grows. But I have found niches, like pockets. and I'll find like excuses to go somewhere. So I feel like, oh, I'll like host this conference. And then while I'm there, I'll like do a few spots. I randomly have a following in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Like these things have come up, you know, just like
amazing. Amazing. That's fantastic. Yeah.
So
you have to build on that, I guess, right?
Yeah. And you just go back every year or twice a year and do it. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So, and then, so Flipside, because you were on the, you were a road warrior with Flipside.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I felt like that New York Times thing might have exaggerated it slightly, but like, you know, nobody goes and sees movies in theaters anymore.
Yeah.
So the only way to get a critical mass of people to come out and see something is you make an event out of it. So for instance, you know, Ira Glass came and did a Q&A, or, you know, like I would get notable, interesting people to do Q&As. They maybe had a little bit of an audience or social media following of their own. And then those were the shows that would sell out and the people would come. But like a documentary screening in, you know, upstate New York, you know, they're only going to program it for like a week. Like it's not, it, you know, it's a very, very incremental, tiny kind of theater by theater thing. And that kind of old school monoculture thing where it might have, Flipside, you know, at some point maybe could have even been discovered. And, but like nobody goes and watches things that way. And I was thinking how, what an obsolete idea it is to like go to a room where a thing plays every 2 hours, you know, like how it just totally obsolete that feels. But yeah, so it was great when I was there and people came out, but like, it's just very challenging. Like there's just, you know, you can't be in every place at once. And then what I didn't realize is like, I had made a documentary a bunch of years ago and you'd get a review in the weekly, you know, in Seattle or Austin or LA, and then people would go and see it. And you could actually maybe even do a little publicity in the buildup to it. And what was happening now that I learned about how things are programmed is they would wait to see how it did in LA and New York in the theater. And then they would program if it seemed to do okay. But they would only make the choice to program it like a few days later. So literally the next week it would be showing. So there was no opportunity in certain of these cases for me to like go there and promote it. And then by the way, there's no more weekly papers. There's no more like, you know what I mean? The local DJ doesn't do the interview. You know what I mean? Like all, I mean, I feel like in Gen X, you know, like I'm telling some grim Tom Petty song about the last DJ or something, but it's true though, that like all of that infrastructure that supported subcultures and independent stuff and small places to go show films, like it was all gone. Like it had existed when I made this first documentary. And then when I went back, I was like, oh, none of that exists anymore. Like the weekly paper was such a, you know, a utility, the Village Voice, the Stranger, you know, and again, all gone. So that was, it was really, I was a little naive about how that part of the process was going to work, the promotion of it, you know, but we got very lucky. We got some incredible national recognition for a film that would at any given moment wasn't even playing nationally. You know, it'd be in New York or it would be in Montclair, New Jersey, or, you know what I mean? But it wouldn't, you know, but we got like a New Yorker review and, you know, the LA Times, and we got some really great, amazing publicity, which was a gift, because that's worth so much money, you know, just in terms of people awareness. And so that was a big part of it kind of continuing, and then even getting on Delta, you know what I mean? Like that's a whole, there's a whole, you know, aftermarket phenomena of negotiating those things, airlines, international airlines. And it's a thing, because you collect tiny little bits of money and the hope is that incrementally, you know, you kind of can make your money back. So like, you know, European distribution and blah, blah, blah. So we're still chasing all that stuff.
Right. Have you released in Europe yet?
No, it's currently with a distributor who's now kind of doing the hard sell and like, you know, knocking on all the doors, and it's territory by territory. It's totally, this crazy glacial process. So, and again, it's all the same thing there, the same struggles and limitations and what the streamers are and aren't buying.
Right. You know? Cause I feel like they would love that. Like they love the artsy.
I hope so. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of the same stuff we were experiencing in the States, which is just like, you know, the people in your film are not particularly famous. You know, it's unusual. It's not an immediate clickbait marketing algorithm spiking thing. It's like a quiet personal essay film.
Right.
You know, and those are the things that you used to be able to discover in the midst of all of that stuff. And now I just think a lot of that stuff's, I mean, I mean, I have friends who had films that were at Sundance and did well and even got awards, and they're languishing. They didn't get distribution, you know, because there's, right. they're not getting bought, you know? So it's unnerving. It's scary.
Yeah. Did you dip into the social media aspect of trying to explain your film in 30 seconds?
Yeah, no, I mean, I tried. I mean, I did, you know, some podcast stuff and some print stuff. And I definitely felt like I had moments where I was like, God, the people who follow me, like, do they want to hear about the freaking screening in Muskogee? Like, I felt like at a certain point, like I was wearing out my welcome as a person posting things, you know what I mean? And I still kind of feel that way, which is like, all right, enough with the flip side already. Like, again, these are people I know or people in my immediate orbit. And I suppose I shouldn't think that way, but I definitely have moments where I'm like, because I know what it's like also when you follow a person and they do like 17 story reposts of the same thing that they, you're just like, why am I, you know, like I was liking social media as a place to do something creative, like a photograph that I liked to post. And then for Flipside, it sort of switched into this tool to just be constantly sort of, but you know, again, it's useful. A person I know who lives in San Francisco and I'm making them aware of a screening that's happening up there. And then they go and they say, great. Oh God, I got to see it. So I don't know. I felt like I have a more complicated Gen X feeling.
You feel,
things.
You're like, wait a minute. It's not like super like authentic. And will I bother people? And I don't want to like push it and be, you know.
And it's all the worst Gen X instincts of, you know, being ambivalent about self-promotion. And I never totally got with the brand part of things, you know, like you sound like you kind of gave in at a certain point and you got good at it and you found your way of using the medium to your advantage. But I still squirm a little, you know. Like, I just want to tell a quick stupid story.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
I recently, so I'm doing a commercial job right now and we needed to do some casting. And, you know, my thing about casting is you would sort of post something and say, we are looking for people. And we were looking for people who were a little bit more interesting and cool. And we asked a Gen, what's below you? Is it Gen Z?
It's Gen Z, Z right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We asked this lovely, smart, thoughtful Gen Z woman who's, you know, she has a lot of cool friends. And we just felt like she's going to be able to tap into a vein of person for this casting that we can't. So she agrees to do it. And the first thing on her personal social media, she posts this total thirst trap photo of herself. And she's basically like, for the algorithm. And then she's like, anyone interested in casting for this thing, blah, 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 blah. And like, she put herself out there because that's the way it works. And it was really funny because it totally worked. Her DMs immediately lit up with people who were interested in the project. You know what I mean? And like, that is unfathomable to me that I would put myself out there on my own social media in the name of a commercial casting job that I was doing to provoke interest and to get the algorithm to then put me out there as just like the image that's going to be distributed in the most. And I just, that was a moment where I was like, fuck, like I'm old. Like this is generational. Like I'm not, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like I'm not,
yeah, yeah.
Like that was another tier of like, and by the way, it totally worked. She found amazing people. Yeah. And she felt no ambivalence about doing it. Like she, this was like, she's like, this is the way it works. And I was just like, you know what I mean? Like I was dumbfounded. I was like, oh my God, I'm so naive and this is ridiculous. But anyway, sorry.
You could make it funny and put like a ridiculous picture of yourself trying to be a thirst trap. And then
I know, but I just, I feel like that would be too, the thinking that needs to happen, it's that is like a meta Gen X approach as opposed to like the algorithm distributed her because of her thirst trap photo, not because of a meta middle-aged dude making a commentary. Do you know what I mean? Right. Like it wouldn't work. It would just be my self-consciousness embedded in the thing.
Well, there is someone who does that. She does. She like makes, she basically tries to recreate thirst trap and then she gets a following because it's funny. You know, watching someone try. So, I mean, it could, if you were, it might bomb.
Okay, well, I will remember that in the future. Yeah.
It might bomb. You have to make it really obvious and be like really ridiculous about it.
Yeah.
It'd be funny. Okay, cool. So we always ask people their misfit moment, the moment that they knew that the traditional path was not for them.
Wow. The moment the path was not for me. Well, I was thinking about, before we were going to talk, sort of my misfit chronology
Yep.
And I remember, this might be a convoluted version of the story, but I lived in a town in suburban New Jersey where there was three towns and two high schools. So one of the towns got split in two. So I lived in the town that they split in two. So I went to this new high school. And what had happened is everyone I grew up with and knew for years either went to the other high school or didn't want to go to this high school. So they all disappeared. They went to boarding school or they went to Catholic school. Or so I show up at this place. I don't know anyone. I'm also in the throes of like Frankensteinian puberty awkwardness, like, you know what I mean? And then the day before the first day of school, I broke my foot riding a bike, right? So I literally walk in this pubescent Frankenstein, limping, broken foot, freshman. And by the way, the lowest tier of low in high school, you know, is the freshman male. And I just remember it was just, it took like a couple of years to even find like a group of people and friends. But the secret trick to it all was that I got a job in this record store. And this is the record store that I went on to make this documentary about. And it was there that I found my people, right? It was where anyone who came to this record store, it was a very particular place. It was selling bootlegs and metal and punk and, you know, it was all underground zines. And so anyone who was there had an interest and obsession with this stuff. And I was living this secret life where I was kind of miserable in my day-to-day high school life. But then I would go to this oasis and I had these people and I even had a little like micro celebrity of being like behind the counter and, you know, the expert on things. And I sort of experienced. So that job was absolutely life-changingly transformative in terms of realizing that, you know, you're looking for your soulmates, you know, in the creatively speaking. Yeah. And so that was why I think the midlife return there was, you know, kind of meaningful because it was that kind of IRL, you know, kind of like so version sweet. Of, so that was a very meaningful sort of
we love
secret
it.
Life. Thank you. I appreciate it. The drops.
I love it. So, okay. So we also ask people what their misfit inspiration is, the misspiration, if you will. That's what, you read or look at when you're in the doldrums and the creative.
Yeah. Let me think for a second. See, you're going to kill me because I'm going to like freeze up here and then you might have to make an edit.
All good. It's
God, I'm so bad on the spot.
Okay. Well, I guess like, what do you, stuff that you might go to when you're like, this is painful.
Yeah.
Or do you just not do anything and just.
No, there's definitely stuff I return to, and I don't know why I'm having an absolute on-the-spot brain freeze. You're going to have to edit. See, I thought we were cooking in such a way that there wasn't an edit in there. Wait. What do I return to? Well, the thing is like, I don't feel like I'm one of those Gen Xers who's like, it is all nostalgia. You know what I mean? Right. That like everything, you know, I am just going back and there's nothing good. And like, I still feel just relentlessly inspired by stuff, you know, every day. And I feel like it's those discoveries that I still feel so excited about and alive to. And I don't know, I was driving last night. I had to drop off a friend of one of my kids. And it was like midnight. It was on a Sunday night. And I just stumbled onto this lecture that Billy Bragg was giving at the Library of Congress. And it was just utterly fascinating. And he was so authoritative talking about this substrain of music, like skiffle. And I was just like, I don't know. I was just reminded of sort of like, there's just this endless amount of stuff to discover. And to sort of renew your sense of inspiration. I know this is a terrible answer, but you know, you even brought up Maria Bamford. Like what she does is like so at its base level interesting as comedy, but then there's like this whole conceptual layer she brings to it. And then there's this impossibly vulnerable personal layer that I can't fathom. I mean, the way she's talking about money and her parents and then I haven't gone to one of these, but friends of mine have gone where you can literally go, you know, she's performing at 9 a.m.
Yeah, so at, fun.
Yeah. Yeah, or she'll, she's literally performing across from you having coffee. And it's just like, I see that and I just feel like my brain is explodes with like the endless one-upsmanship of herself and her,
right,
what she's doing and how she's thinking about it and the ambition, yeah, of trying those things and committing. Like it's, and it's non, it's not commercial. It's not a social media post. Like she's doing it as this like kind of obsessive way of, you know, testing the viability of a creative idea. I don't know. She kind of blows my mind in that, yeah, way. Maybe you could do an edit where we cut out the awkward silence and we go straight to the Maria Bamford of it all.
Maybe. It's good.
I'm sorry about that. I just froze,
great.
Let's get rid of the Billy Bragg lecture. But I think what I was just trying to say is just like, I feel like every day I'll find some social media site where I'm like, oh my God, this is brilliant. You know? And you're just like, you can't believe that you have missed this for the last 2 years and that there's been these posts.
Well, I feel that. I think it's like, you know, looking at something that you can't imagine yourself doing, like another genre, totally. Like I look at something, you know, like even watching something like Flipside. I don't know. And I'm not a documentary filmmaker. That's not my thing. And so like, it's just like, I can't understand how people do it, or like go see an art exhibit. Cause I'm like, I don't understand how people put a pen in their hand and come out with a drawing.
Where did you see Flipside, by the way? Did you stumble onto it? Like on a,
no, Andrea told me about it. She actually, when you were in town, she was like, you gotta come. And then I wasn't able to get there, as New York is.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh no. And then, so I watched it and that's how. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And Andrea Claire, I met my wife at Andrea Claire's wedding. So I don't,
wow,
know if you remember, there's a scene in Flipside where I literally took video of my wife an hour after I met her, because I was, my wedding gift to Andrea Claire was to videotape her wedding. I shot the wedding. I met my wife there, and then it makes it into the story of Flipside.
Oh my God, that's so sweet.
It's very sweet.
I love
so
that.
So I owe Andrea Claire karmically, oh, wow, and personally. And,
amazing.
Yeah.
She's amazing. I love her.
We met at Cal Arts, you know, which was like a misfit.
Oh, yeah.
Hub. Yeah.
Right. That was where PB Herman went too, right?
Yeah. 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 Absolutely.
I just watched his documentary.
That, yeah, so amazing.
Yeah, that brilliant. Was really good. Yeah. Cool. So I have a question from Carmela Rivoli. She's my character. Anyway, you'll meet her in a second. Okay. Hi. Hello, Chris. Hi. I'm from Brooklyn, but I live in Boca Raton. You're from Jersey. I feel like, you know, some kinship there. We have some things. You might have met people like myself somewhere along your journeys, but now you're in Los Angeles. So
yes,
I'm
possibly
sorry
my own mother.
Yes. Oh, yes. Your mother. I saw your mother. I liked her right away. She told Judd Apatow, yeah, like, screw you. You screwed up my family life. I love that. I admire
bold.
Her very much.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
was maybe my favorite character of the whole thing. I got to say for that. I thought she was amazing. I was like, what a cow. So, okay. I just want to know, you know, I'm a boomer, so whatever. Eugenics are weird. But, you know, I think, you know, you're all into this, like, staying true to yourself. I wonder though, was it always a pipe dream? You know, were you always like, yeah, let's be authentic, but it was just never going to last. You know, it was just there to say it and try to be cool. Or did you really believe it? What do you think? Was it ever possible?
I mean, I think it was an obsession, and I think it was a fight worth fighting. I think we lost.
Yeah.
And I think any attempts at authenticity were subsumed so quickly by, you know, first, you know, advertising and marketing and now social media. And, you know, so I think we lost. I think we lost that battle. I think it was, you know, and I feel old even acknowledging that I was fixated on it for so long.
Oh, that's right. Fixated on being true to yourself, being authentic. That's how quaint. Doesn't it feel so quaint now? It feels
like it does. It's like, you know, pathetic.
Yes. It's like, you know, like Colonial Williamsburg does their thing. Yeah. The Woodstock, they do the drum circle, and the Gen X, you know, hanging out in record stores being like, fuck, you know, selling out. Fuck that shit.
Yeah.
That's
obsolete.
That's, we need
instantly obsolete.
maybe this is it. Flip side. This is the new thing, what they're going to do after the record store guy goes. It's going to be a reenactment center for Gen X.
That is, I feel like you have stumbled onto something brilliant, where we sit around and we shoot analog film and we play our little vinyl records and yes. we obsess about authenticity and we look at our fanzines that we've saved for 30 years. Yeah, I think yes. that would be there could be a chain of them.
Yes, absolutely. All across the country, people can relive their day. And you got to have arguments about who's selling out and this album is this way. It's commercial and this person. And like, who's the coolest by who knows the most fringe song by someone
exactly.
somewhere.
All those pathetic obsessions. Yeah. What major label you did or didn't sign to and who, you know, the stakes could not have been lower.
Yes. Chris, don't be so mean to yourself, pathetic. What do you mean, pathetic?
Stop. No. I think I'm just lamenting where we've arrived at.
Well, yes, the hacks have taken over the earth. But, you know, but flip side, though, I do think the little Gen Zs, they're so sick of it. And I do think they look for things. So it's a matter of just and a matter of time. I feel like once the Gen Z starts making TikToks about your film, there will be a wall over it. They're like,
yeah, well, I have to say, I wondered if it was only would have an appeal to like a Gen X audience, but it's been nice. Like I showed it at a college recently, and I was very surprised that these undergrads who were about to graduate into this very unknown world really identified with the struggle, right? Of like making things and putting things in the world and how to do that. And so that was a kind of nice small epiphany that there was appeal beyond just a Gen X audience.
Right. Because, I mean, it's obvious to everyone, like just someone puts their butt crack on Instagram and makes $1 million. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So what can you do? But we're doing better things. Here we go. All right. So I'm going to go, Chris. I'll see you later. I'm going to go by the pool. I got to get pool time.
Enjoy.
Today. Okay,
enjoy.
Bye. So that's Carmella.
She's a familiar character. I played straight man to her. I didn't know what to do. I was paralyzed with fear. No, I recognize. I mean, again, you know, growing up in New Jersey, it is, you know, that is a familiar character.
Right. You know, she's interesting. I've tried her to bring her on social media and she just does not work. However, like on stage, I do the Misfit Variety Show and she's like the one, she steals the show, honestly, every time.
Now, what do you make of that? Why would it work live and not?
I think part of her magic is what you're saying. Like she gets things out of people and she also, well, I get things out of people too, but I think the magic is in the room. She does this audience response thing and she's getting people to, they write vulnerable things on the paper, but then she's reading them. And you would think someone like her, this boomer, is going to be like, yeah, that's right. You were embarrassed by this thing and feel shame. You were an idiot. Instead, she's like, I hate that person who did this. You know what? That person's a piece of shit. You tell them I said, fuck you, you know? You know, so she's like, she's almost like I think in the room, it's like this person. You wish that was your parent or that older person in your life defending you for your uniqueness. I think that's what happens.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That is a very smart perspective shift that it seems like you could do a lot with.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
It's all of that like in the ether. So we'll see. But not all the I have to finish things. I have to finish.
No, them, I know. It's so hard.
It's so hard. All right, Kristen, now where can people come find you? Find out about Flipside.
I mean, I'm on Instagram at Chris Wilcha. And that's kind of it at the moment. I mean, it's sort of, again, a pathetic Gen X lack of self-promotion.
No.
But, you know, I'm still doing my thing. I'm making things.
Don't make fun of
yourself. Yeah, self-deprecation of Gen X was a signature.
Yeah, it's a thing. That's right. In the reenactment, you guys can be like taking, you know, self-deprecating, doing the things. Okay.
Exactly. Yep. It's you know. And I'm just, again, pitching a bunch of documentary stuff and just trying to figure out how to keep making a living doing this, making stuff.
Right. Well, rock on, Chris.
Thank you for your very thoughtful conversation. And I feel like I appreciate you being so enthusiastic about Flipside and I'm glad it resonated in some way.
Ah, thank you. Thank you for making it. Thank you for answering all my weird nerdy questions. So thank you.
That's great. Thank you.
there we have it. You can follow Misfits Making It on my social pages at Lauren Logi on all the things, Instagram especially, and also X Twitter thing and Threads and TikTok and YouTube Shorts and all the things. You can get updates and inside info by joining my email list at www.laurenlogi.com. Thank you to Ani Makutsian for editing, Edward Schilla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Thank you to Maureen Asiant for our new music and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast. And thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The preceding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.